Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. For nearly 20 years, StoryCorps has been recording, preserving, and sharing the stories of Americans from all backgrounds and beliefs. The nonprofit group has created countless driveway moments for NPR listeners since its inception in 2003, compiling the largest collection ever of voices, those of ordinary people talking to each other about what matters to them. We're talking about storytelling and why it still matters. Coming up, StoryCorps founder Dave Isay joins us. Doreen Juha-Sauer is a Columbus historian and education outreach coordinator for Columbus Landmarks. Welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
David Mould is a professor emeritus of media arts and studies at Ohio University. He's a historian and author of the 2009 book, Catching Stories, A Practical Guide to Oral History. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Anne. Glad to join you.
So, David, when we say oral history, is this the only distinction, that it is spoken versus read?
Yes, spoken rather than written. I mean, you know, the value of oral history is that it records the, you know, the memories, or should we say the histories, of people who haven't written them down, either because they didn't think they were important enough to write down, or because nobody wrote them down for us. So it's a very, I view oral history as a way of democratizing history, and should we say spreading the power of history, the power of memory as well.
Doreen Juha-Sauer, you tell history to people. You share stories about historical places in Columbus. How has that changed over the years? I mean, how does your voice change what people hear?
I think that's a really good question. I think the other guest has really landed on it when he mentioned democracy. It is so much more about what the average person thinks, and the person who's been marginalized before this, the person who believes that my story, it doesn't make any difference, especially when it comes to, I think all history is really dependent upon narrative, and narrative is dependent upon setting. And for some people, they think, you know, I live in the most ordinary neighborhood, or I live in a neighborhood that is not enriched in any way, in the sense of perhaps a neighboring suburb. So there is no story, and yet theirs is the richest story of all. And sometimes we can only get at it through their voice.
I've as a journalist, of course, I've lived by the credo that there's a million stories in the naked city, right? But
right.
But when, David Mould, when you hear it from somebody's own lips, there's a difference too, right?
Absolutely, because people tell their stories in their own way. I mean, in a sense, I don't want to overblow this, but there's a sense that every interview is a unique historical document. If I was to interview Anne or interview Doreen, it would be different from somebody else interviewing you. There may be some of the same content, but, you know, the interplay because of gender and age and background would make it a unique historical document. So there's something very rich about the oral history interview, which gives us a sense of place, a sense of time, and how somebody views the past. I think we have a little.
Okay, we'll fix that technicality there. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the art of storytelling today, in honor of the StoryCorps bus, which is in Columbus this month. For more information about the project, you can go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. I also want to let you know that Columbus Metropolitan Club will host a conversation about storytelling tomorrow in honor of StoryCorps. I'll be moderating the event, and that will feature the site manager of the StoryCorps mobile tour, also Ruth Milligan, the founder of TEDx Columbus, and WOSU Public Media General Manager Tom Ryland. And for more information on tickets, you can go to metroclub.org. If you want to talk about the art of storytelling, if you have been to the StoryCorps bus now and participated in this project, give us a call and tell us what it was like. I've never been in it, so I'm as curious as anybody who hasn't been there. Tell us what you experienced. 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, Doreen, I know you've also been a teacher, and I wondered what it's like to work with younger people telling oral histories.
Well, I think there's a great example. It's actually with the WOSU Neighborhood Series, and it was the students I worked with at Fort Hays and their teacher, Eric East, doing interviews in Milo Grogan. And the students really embraced Milo Grogan, which is the closest physical neighborhood to the location of the school. And it was amazing to me because the hardest part sometimes is the follow-up question. You can have a list of questions in front of you, things you would like people to talk about, and they start to go down that road, but you're not quite sure how to do the next question, or do you cut them off at this point? The technique is sort of you kind of acquired, I guess. And their job was just, they were so professional about it, and they were so relaxed about it that it was a joy to watch. And I think in a way there was another dynamic going on, and that is that high school kids often relate much better to people of their grandparents' age than their parents' age. And I think that is a generational factor. And grandparents sometimes understand their grandchildren in a very different way and less judgmentally. And that became an important factor in that oral history.
You know, not knowing where the conversation is going to take you is an acquired skill in a way. David Mould, you know, you think you know what the story is maybe when you're starting to ask the questions, but maybe the story doesn't turn out the way you think. That's got to be kind of almost magical.
I think it is. And by the way, I'm sorry you lost me.
Oh, no, that's okay.
Oral history.
Modern technology.
Technology. Yes. I mean, I think that's the joy and the special thing about oral history. You go into a situation thinking that you kind of know what the story is, and you expect the interviewee, the narrator, to kind of retell it for you. And then things take off often in surprising directions. And I think Doreen has made a good point here that you need to leave interviewees some freedom to pursue tangents, because let's face it, in an interview is kind of like a transaction. You know, the interviewer knows kind of what they want to get out of it, but the interviewee has something they want to say. I mean, they may have an agenda, a political agenda, or a personal agenda, and, you know, so allowing them to, you know, go off on what sometimes seems a tangent can actually reveal a very, very interesting story. I remember one interview I edited for public radio a long time ago, not an interview I did, by a folklorist who was interviewing the widow of a miner who had died in the Mannington mine disaster in West Virginia. And the interview went on for about an hour and a half. And at the end, Michael Klein, the interviewer, asked her, he said, "Could you just tell me she said, "I'd like to tell you what happened on the day my husband died." You know, it was really not a question at all. She said, "I want to tell you." And he let her go. I think we did two edits on that bit of audio tape at that point, because it was a complete story, a story of disaster, a story of love, very special. But if you don't give the interviewee the freedom to say something there and essentially say what they want to say, and you stay on your questions, then you may lose those very special moments.
I remember one time I was doing a feature story about a family that was into jigsaw puzzles. And I got there and I thought, okay, I'm going to do this story. But I found out that there were four generations of people living in the same house together.
Wow.
And I thought that was pretty amazing. And we ended up talking about that for my whole visit. And I wrote the story and my editor loved it.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting sometimes when you're in a neighborhood that people are giving you their experiences. We did cultural walks about 3 years ago with Columbus Landmarks and a grant from the Ohio Humanities, and where people were telling their own stories. And I'm used to being sort of the tour guide, so, you know, I get to be the ultimate filter, I guess. And this was interesting because it was just kind of being the tag along and helping to having orchestrated who would like to talk about what, but you still have the pop-up person who comes. And when you're dealing with it was a neighborhood in Columbus in which I would say it's a predominantly Caucasian neighborhood. When I ask a question about were there African-Americans in the high school when you graduate? Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And I knew that they only came from about three different neighborhoods, three specific places. It was very interesting because I never really mentioned it again until the day of the walk, when women who were about my age, and I was born before the end of World War II, came up to me and said, "We never knew there was this little neighborhood near us. We had never thought about it, but you showed us this advertisement about restricted housing when that their neighborhood was new." And I don't know why I asked, but I simply said, "Since you went to an integrated high school, where did you ever ask where people lived?" And the one woman said, "Yes, I did." And this was echoed by the second woman who said, "Yes, I did too. And our mothers said to us, ladies don't ask such questions." And I think that was more revealing to me because of that generation, that that's a whole other thing. Now they're sort of looking at their neighborhood differently in a more national light, how we were all affected by public policy, by segregation, by industrialization, all of that. And I think that's the richness of being able to have people feel comfortable enough to say something.
You know, David Mold, I wanted to go back to something that Doreen Juha-Sauer mentioned, and that was the generational differences and how teens often relate to older people more readily than they do their own parents. Maybe less judgment, lots of other things. Maybe the stories seem more distant, more foreign in a way, if you will. What about that? What about who's hearing a story and who's telling a story and how that interaction goes when it comes to age?
I think that's an important issue, and there's a kind of broader issue. It's kind of what we sometimes call stranger value. In a sense, the most difficult people to interview are members of your own family, you know, your spouse or your children, because, you know, you already share something in common. And, you know, and being able to step out of the world of being a relation to being an interviewer is a very, very difficult one. I think that when you have that, you know, one generation distance between a child and a grandparent, then that becomes easier. But I mean, you know, these are part of the sort of interesting dynamics of interviews, that every person doing an interview is going to get a different perspective there. So yeah, I mean, there are all these factors we have to build in: age, gender, race, you know, political views, cultural background, which make the interview very rich. Can I just make one other point here, building on what something Doreen said? I mean, one of the interesting things as a historian is when people, should we say, misremember the past, and maybe Doreen's experiences, where somebody says, this happened, or this happened in this year or this place, and you can show from written records that that is incorrect. It didn't happen that way. What do we do with that?
Yeah.
There's a famous case by the Italian oral historian Alessandro Portelli. I love to say that name. where he showed, he did interviews with auto workers in Turin, and they telescoped time, and they put together the Allied liberation of the city with communist strikes that happened 2 years later. Now, we can show historically that those were separate events, but in their minds, they were very much connected. So the way in which people reconstruct their past and sometimes telescope time and put events together, the way they do that, I don't think we should reject that. I mean, traditional historians would reject, but I think the way in which people remember or maybe misremember the past is also historically significant.
I couldn't agree more. And in fact, in a rather strange course of events, I noticed that sometime in the mid-70s, maybe even early 80s, I would run into a number of gentlemen who actually had... it's hard to say fabricated, but I'm just going to say had created sort of a background for themselves where they had an involvement within the Vietnam War and they hadn't. And I grew up in a very working class neighborhood in Cleveland where a lot of young men were in Vietnam. And what was interesting is the ones who were there rarely talked about it. The ones who weren't there generally had some relation. And I started to almost see that as if, you know, if I had a Fulbright to study this or some grant, it would have been very interesting, because I think it's how we as humans deal with guilt. I really do. It's like looking at the background of a ghost story that comes to you from a culture that tells you more about the culture than there was ever, if there was a specter there or not. You sort of see something deeper happening.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the art of storytelling. You just heard Doreen Neuhaus-Sauer. She's a Columbus historian and education outreach coordinator for Columbus Landmark. She's also a former teacher, as we mentioned earlier. Also with us, David Mould. He's a professor emeritus of media arts and studies at Ohio University. He's a historian and author of the 2009 book, Catching Stories, A Practical Guide to Oral History. We are doing this in honor of StoryCorps, which is in Columbus to the end of the month. For more information, you can check out the link at our website at wosu.org/allsides. And Columbus Metropolitan Club is hosting a conversation about storytelling tomorrow in honor of StoryCorps. I'll be moderating the event. It'll feature the site manager of StoryCorps' mobile tour. Also, the founder of TEDx Columbus, co-founder of TEDx Columbus, Ruth Milligan, and WOSU Public Media's general manager, Tom Ryland. And for information about tickets, go to metroclub.org. Hope to see you there. If you have a question or comment, want to join this conversation about storytelling, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. That idea, a lot of people, I think, were having similar experiences about telescoping time in the past week when we all tried to remember where we were when we saw the moon landing. We were having a conversation on a panel I was on and debating, was it in the afternoon? Was it at night? But I remember it as being in the middle of the day, but it wasn't. But it was in the summer, so it might have been light outside. I'm trying to console myself. It was pretty late, but I just remember my dad yelling, and it has to get in here, and you got to watch history happening. You know, the actual sound of somebody's voice, David Mould, how does that play into the value of storytelling?
I think it makes the story absolutely come alive because somebody's tone of voice, the rhythms of their speech, are very, very important. I mean, it's quite interesting when you look at a written transcript of an oral history interview. I mean, it's sometimes rather difficult to read, and you want to kind of correct it and fix the punctuation and the pauses and things like that. But there's a richness to the spoken word, which the written word really doesn't convey. I mean, the written word tends to kind of organize language. It's the way we write. You know, we write with sentences. Well, I hope we write with sentences and punctuation and all of that. But the spoken word is much more spontaneous. And so, you know, I think actually the act of writing, I mean, I do a lot of writing, so I'm not going to put it down too much. But, I mean, I think the act of writing organizes one's thoughts in a way which, into a cohesive form. The spoken word is much more spontaneous. So I think there's a richness there that is to some degree lost in the written word.
Doreen, you lead tours all over the city with all different kinds of themes. We've gone with you with WOSU many times because yes, you're such a great friend of WOSU and have done that for us. And I was wondering, as you tell the stories of the history of Columbus through its buildings, do your stories change or do details from the stories change in importance over time, or depending
on? I'm not sure
on,
they purposely change.
No, not purposely. That's
right.
What I mean.
But I do think that there is a difference sometimes when you pick up. You're doing it in front of an audience, essentially, and so you're picking up on visual cues from them a lot of times. And so, given a little bit of license, I can be far more dramatic on occasion than I would normally be. Then I'm much more what I was in the classroom, you know, because it's a little bit of humor and it's a little this and a little that, and and you can relate things, even very serious things, to each other. When you feel that you have broken down, there's an openness between yourself and the people who are listening to find out a little bit more about this building, this setting. And I guess when I say building and I think about landmarks and how we have stories about them, what's the most interesting to me is that they are not the grand buildings. And as you know, my colleague, Tom Betty, who is much younger than I, and we do these things together. Mm-hmm. And Tom is so taken with the grand hotels and this. And I am like rooting around in the alley looking for the slum, you know. And so I guess we sort of make a good counterpart to each other in that sense. But I'm looking for those stories that make people cross time and say, oh, my God, for the sake of all other things, if I had been born in the 19th century and I was standing outside of Dempsey's where the jury room is, and I was, you know, Fannie Miller, who was accused of killing the young man outside the door, was I doing it because I hated him? Was I doing it because I was scared, or because I had a 13-year-old daughter inside who was cowering? And so you have a way of telling a story differently each time, depending on who you are talking about. I want to go back to a different segment of the population for just a moment, because mm-hmm. I'm wondering if David's had experience with this. One of the best things is really oral histories of children, and having children tell you a story, and half of it is perhaps true, and half of it is what they are projecting. Mm-hmm. It just is absolutely wonderful. I had a long, involved, I'm going to say, tour a number of years ago with preschoolers downtown, and we were talking about animals on buildings. And so we went through kind of an academic exercise. Is this a real animal? If it's not. And there was a griffin on the outside of the Huntington Bank building. And we established, again, is it a lion or is it an eagle or is it a mixed up eagle lion? And for some reason, I asked one of the children, does anybody... what do you think about a bank using an imaginary animal on the outside of its building? And this little hand shot up and it said, because your money's not really there. And it was just like, you know, like out of the mouths of babes.
Remember Art Linkletter? The kids say the darndest things. That was one of my favorite things ever, watch that show.
In the Milo Art Center, I don't know if he's still there, but so last year there was an artist who was doing oral histories of children telling him stories and then animating them. And they were absolutely the most precious and beautiful stories. And a sort of renewed everything about humanity to you when you heard them. They were great.
Well, I want to thank you, Doreen Neuhausauer, for joining us today to talk about this. I appreciate your time.
I enjoy it so much. Thank you.
Doreen Neuhausauer, Columbus historian, former teacher, education outreach coordinator for Columbus Landmarks, and David Mould, a professor emeritus of media arts and studies at Ohio University, an historian and author of the 2009 book, Catching Stories, A Practical Guide to Oral History. David, thank you so much.
My pleasure indeed. Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to hear from the founder of StoryCorps, Dave Isay, so stay with us and hopefully share your experiences with StoryCorps if you want to, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about storytelling and why it matters today. 16 years ago, for 16 years, StoryCorps has been recording, preserving, and sharing the stories of Americans from all backgrounds and beliefs. Every year, StoryCorps travels across the country to find more voices. And the StoryCorps trailer is in Columbus through July 31st, so you can check out the link at wosu.org/allsides for more information about that. Dave Isay is the founder of StoryCorps, and he joins us now. Welcome back, Dave.
And it's great to be back.
It's wonderful to have you.
it's been a few years, but you've been busy. StoryCorps has not abated in any size, shape, or form.
Well, there's a lot of work to do. Yeah, I mean, StoryCorps is really about, you know, I think listeners know after all these years, it's this very simple idea of two people, you know, coming to a booth with the help of a facilitator, unless you're using our app and you do it yourself. But it's about listening to others and telling them that they matter and they won't be forgotten by just asking them questions about their lives. So we now, you know, the collection is a lot bigger than last time I was on. Mm-hmm. We have about 500,000 people who participated. So it's the largest collection of human voices ever gathered. And essentially, we're collecting the wisdom of humanity. And, you know, in so many ways, StoryCorps is, you know, about the best of who we are. And, you know, listening to each other and being kind to each other and remembering that all of our stories and all of our lives matter equally and infinitely. And it's not been a great time for that in the country.
Right. Right. Exactly. And I wondered if the times, if over the course of the 16 years and those 500,000 memories and those 500,000 conversations, if you've seen any kinds of trends that reflect the times that we're in right now?
No, so as I said, I mean, what happens in a StoryCorps interview is that, you know, each of these interviews go to the Library of Congress. And when people come into a booth, they realize they're speaking to future generations. Mm-hmm. And many people think of it as, if I had 40 minutes left to live, you know, what would I say to this person who means so much to me? What would I ask of them? And, you know, across geography, what happens in a booth does not change. I mean, the accents change, the occupations change. And across the years, it doesn't change. I mean, people talk about the great themes of human existence. It's about family. It's about love. It's about death. You know, it's about your work often. But it absolutely does not change. You know, one of the reminders of StoryCorps, we've had hundreds and hundreds of facilitators who serve a year or two with StoryCorps, and their job is to travel around, you know, on our booths and with other ways that we collect stories and bear witness to what happens in the booth, be there for participants. And when facilitators come off the road, if you ask them what they've learned, the first answer is always some version of that Anne Frank quote, which is that people are basically good. And that's also something that I think we've lost sight of a little bit in this country.
You know, as far as technology goes, how do you breach the digital divide in this country? The people who, you know, don't have the speed dial, you know, they can't get on within 2 minutes and sign up for StoryCorps like others can.
So we, you know, StoryCorps is about America, and we have a fierce commitment to people, all people. And, you know, the ethos of StoryCorps, which you can probably figure out from listening to the stories on the radio, is about, you know, that you know, none of us are the worst thing we've ever done, and always assuming the best in others, and all these kind of truths about who we are as people. And we also have a fierce commitment to making sure that every possible kind of voice, every possible American voice is honored through StoryCorps. And, you know, it's really more about, StoryCorps is more about listening than about storytelling. Mm-hmm. So when we come to Columbus, half our slots are held for people who hear about us through OSU, through All Sides, through newspapers. And the other half, we work with dozens of community organizations, nonprofits, to tell that where we hold our slots for those folks. They tell the clients that they serve about StoryCorps, the people they serve. Could be in every city it changes. It could be juvenile justice, homeless services, you know, immigrant groups, whoever it is. And those folks are told about StoryCorps and bring in a loved one and have that experience. So that's why when you hear the broadcasts on Friday, on Morning Edition, you hear such a wide diversity of voices.
And, you know, StoryCorps has grown, obviously, since it started in 2003. How does it manifest now? How do you describe the growth? How does it illustrate it?
Well, I think, you know, we've grown a lot, but we think of it more as having a long way to go. And, you know, the dream with StoryCorps is that someday, you know, again, it's this very simple idea that just helps us connect each other, and you know, to each other in an authentic way. And one of the, you know, paradoxes of this technological age we live in, which is, you know, so much about communication, is that these ways that were built to help us communicate better with each other has in some ways drawn us farther apart. You know, the dream with StoryCorps is that someday we'll be part of the fabric of this country, whether it's StoryCorps or just the ethos of StoryCorps, this idea of the importance of authentic connection to one another and treating each other with dignity and respect, that that the stories, you know, that the stories are everywhere and that everybody records and has this moment. You know, what I like to think, there's two sides to StoryCorps: access to the experience, which is what StoryCorps was built on, which is doing these interviews and, you know, listening to the stories. And I hope both on the stories piece and on the experience piece, StoryCorps just shakes us on the shoulders and reminds us, you know, this is what's important, because we're surrounded by so much noise and nonsense. You know, we can lose sight of what's important, and that's, you know, our family. It's about character. It's about, you know, treating people with kindness.
The facilitators are out there helping people. What do you think helps people the most? They also get lists of questions they can ask each other. What do you think the prompts are that help people the most these days?
Well, the people choose. So this is very much a citizen generated project. Mm-hmm. So when you come with your grandmother, you people prepare. I mean, many years ago I was a journalist, so this comes out of kind of a journalistic background. I used to make documentaries for public radio. So I believe in preparing before an interview, as I know you do.
Mm-hmm.
You do very well. People come and we have something called a question generator. So people choose the questions they want to ask. We have hundreds and hundreds of questions, including the top 10 most popular questions. You choose what you want to ask, reorder it, and then you go in to the interview. And the facilitator will always tell you before you start, you know, ask the question you've always wanted to ask. And, you know, part of what we think of StoryCorps is, you know, I think I can say definitively kind of a sacred space. And it's partly because of it's what the facilitators have created inside. It's not about the space itself. And it's this idea of speaking to the future, because there is no question that that your great-great-great-grandchildren, some generation going forward, is going to listen back on this. So what the facilitator will say is, you know, it's also, as you know, the microphone gives you the license to talk about things you don't normally get to talk about. And the facilitator will say, ask that question you've always wanted to ask. So it's really this opportunity to, you know, in some ways, I know my staff isn't crazy about me saying this, but it's true. You know, in some way, you know, in hospice care, they talk about the four things you want to say before you die: thank you, I love you, forgive me, I forgive you. And hopefully, you know, you're not actively dying when you're in the StoryCorps booth, but it does give you an opportunity to have this kind of closure conversation, if you want to, with someone who means a lot to you.
Do you find that a certain kind of person tends to gravitate toward StoryCorps as far as participating in one of the booth operations?
You know, on participation side, though,
mm-hmm.
You know what's most exciting to me about StoryCorps is that StoryCorps is it everybody gets it, and it appeals beyond, you know, politics. We've done a lot of work in recent years reaching out to conservatives, you know, and StoryCorps has equal appeal to conservatives and liberals. It appeals to everybody, because we all want to connect. We all want to know that we matter. So I don't think there is a kind of there's a sort of person who's particularly drawn to StoryCorps. I know that there are people who are nervous or shy about going into the booth. There are people who feel like their story doesn't matter. We obviously, no one is forced to come in the booth, but it's especially people who feel like their story doesn't matter when they come in the booth and they start talking, that it's particularly meaningful. One of the, you know, many miracles of StoryCorps is that, you know, I was at Facebook, a couple weeks ago talking to someone high up at Facebook. And I said, you know, we've had 500,000 people participate, and, you know, essentially nothing's gone wrong in the booth. you know, because you can think of a million scenarios of things going wrong. And, mm-hmm. and the person from Facebook said, you know, that really strains. I can't believe that. And, you know, and it is, it's true, you know, and I think that there's something about this opportunity, you know, again, to just stop and reflect and say thank you that brings out the very best in who we are.
My guest is founder of StoryCorps, Dave Isay. We're going to take a quick break and then get back to it. So stay with us. By the way, the StoryCorps Mobile Tour is in Columbus through July 31st. You can get more information at WOSU.org/allsides. And also the Columbus Metropolitan Club hosts a conversation about storytelling tomorrow in honor of StoryCorps. I'll be moderating the event. It'll feature the site manager of the StoryCorps Mobile Tour and also the founder of TEDx Columbus, or co-founder, Ruth Milligan, and at WOSU Public Media General Manager Tom Ryland. For more information on tickets, go to metroclub.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. StoryCorps has been recording, preserving, and sharing the stories of Americans from all backgrounds and beliefs since 2003. Every year, StoryCorps travels across the country to find more of those voices. The StoryCorps trailer is in Columbus through July 31st. Check out the link at WOSU.org/allsides for more information. Still with us is the founder of StoryCorps, Dave Isay. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8555. 513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Dave, a friend of mine emailed me the other day and said, hey, do you know how I can get an audition for StoryCorps? I think sometimes people don't understand that those are just ordinary people and they're just talking. It seems too good to be true.
That's funny. Was your friend being serious?
I think so. They
wow.
said, how do you, I think they think that you have to try out to get
yeah.
into the trailer.
No, I mean, I think you'll understand this, and maybe the audience might take a beat to think about it, but we broadcast 1/400th of 1% of what we record. So it's a very, very small percentage. And, you know, we look at every interview as equally valuable and hopefully an important, you know, sometimes kind of a transformative moment in people's lives, not always, sometimes. But that's really what it's about. It's about the experience. And there are occasions where, you know, an interview rises to the level of where, you know, it almost demands to be shared with a larger audience. And a StoryCorps interview is 40 minutes. What you hear on the radio is 3 minutes. And, you know, the idea of these stories that we play are just about, you know, it's about the intimacy of radio, that when you're driving in your car and you hear a StoryCorps story in the morning from someplace, someone who you might never have otherwise gotten to know, it's like they're whispering in your ear. That's the intimacy of radio and talking to you. And it helps us, I like to think, you know, get to know each other better and feel more hopeful and less fearful and, you know, just see the truth of who we are as people. But anybody who comes to StoryCorps hoping to get on the air, that is a sure sign that there is no chance ever that you're going to get on the air. And I should say, you know, that's not the importance of StoryCorps. You know, I did an interview with my dad, who died about the time that I think I was last on the show. I did it a bunch of years before, never thought about it. And then listened to it on the night. He died very, very suddenly. He was, you know, working on a Friday, was diagnosed with cancer that afternoon and was dead by the next Tuesday. And I listened to the StoryCorps interview that evening. Now, the night he died at 3 a.m, knowing that my kids, I'm an old dad. My little kids, this was the only way they were going to get to know this, you know, monumental figure in my life. Now, that interview would have no interest to you or to a larger public, but to me, it's incredibly important. So that's really what it's about. It's about creating this, you know, moment and this document of someone you care about. And being broadcast is very, very much secondary.
You know how people go back and look for records of their ancestors who landed yeah. on, you know, Ellis Island, for instance,
right.
and that kind of a thing. And everyone is so into genealogy these days. I kind of imagine 50 years or 100 years from now, people will be doing the same thing with StoryCorps and sort of mining it for those nuggets that are about their family.
That's exactly right. And to me, that's the importance of the archive is, you know, everybody sees StoryCorps in a different way, even though it's a very simple idea. And I, you know, I think certainly, you know, the historical idea of a bottom-up history of this country is really important. But the real, I think the profound value is generations getting to know, you know, where they came from and getting to meet their ancestors in this very intimate, profound, and honest way.
Do you remember the time when you were on some years ago? And, you know, forgiveness if you, you don't remember this, but it's always stuck with me. You and I were talking, and a guy called up and said, "I'm in my car right now," and we were stopped at a light, and a lady was crying in her car, and I rolled down my window and said, "Are you listening to StoryCorps?" Because we had just aired a piece from it, and she said, "Yes."
That's funny. That's funny.
You know, as far as that connection, it goes beyond just the people in the studio. You know, having that opportunity, it's definitely an appointment listening thing to hear StoryCorps on Fridays.
Well, thanks. Yeah, and you know, people, it's funny because the you know the everybody talks about crying when they hear StoryCorps, and now it's a whole Pavlovian thing with the music comes on, and I mean but you know, I think that you know these are not, for the most part, they're not sad stories.
No.
I think, again, it's just about, you know, remembering what's true and seeing who we can be and just seeing, like, kind of just everyday people at their best and being, you know, being reminded of truths of who we are and the intimacy of radio mm-hmm. and just connecting with someone who you would never otherwise have known and remembering, you know, remembering these great truths of what it means to be human.
Anne in Clintonville, you're on the air with Dave Isay. Hi, Anne.
Hi, Anne. Thank you so much. And Dave, thank you so much for taking my call. What prompted my calling in was that you're saying that StoryCorps, I guess, officially began in 2003. But back in the 80s, when I was super young thing of 50, in my 50s, I started taping my parents. I would go out to California to visit and help them for about 3 weeks, several times a year. And I started recording them, and I was so sure that I had heard Dave on the radio and that at that time, late in the 80s, and that's what prompted me. Am I misremembering?
But you said you were in your 50s in the 1980s?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh, you said, so are you in your 80s now?
I am.
Oh, you sound like you sound younger than I do. First of all, I'm so glad you did that. And, you know, one of the things, there's a hack at the StoryCorps archive where you can actually upload we have an app that makes it possible to do StoryCorps interviews anytime, any place, and with one tap, upload them to the Library of Congress. And there's a hack in there that allows you to upload old interviews. So if you have that interview with your parents, then you should definitely think about uploading it. I made radio documentaries starting in the late 80s. And they were always, you know, it wasn't StoryCorps, but it was always about, you know, just honoring people by listening to them. So maybe you heard me on the radio. I'm honored. And if not, I'm just glad that either way, I'm just glad that you had the chance to interview your folks.
Right. Ian, thanks for that call.
Thank
Anyone else? 614-292-8513. Where's the 40 minutes, the magic of 40 minutes come from? Why that number?
Well, it just worked. You know, there's no magic to it. We run the booth on the hour. So there's 10 minutes at the top with two facilitators. So one facilitator is with one pair, and then the other facilitator is with the other. It's 10 minutes at the top of the hour to get settled into the booth, and then 10 minutes at the end of the hour to kind of, a lot of people cry at StoryCorps. So take a deep breath and to sign release forms if you want to sign release forms, and then it goes at the hour. I as I was just talking about with Anne, you know, I did radio documentaries for many years. And I was never, you know, you have some great, like Errol Morris is a fantastic, legendary documentary maker who would do 24-hour interviews and kind of break people down. and I always found that after 40 minutes or an hour of a very intense conversation that it was kind of diminishing returns. So I find it that the shorter interviews are easier on, like it just felt like the right length. And again, it we started out with that and it worked. So we've stuck with it.
Are children interested in StoryCorps? Do you get people, children who want to participate in it?
Yes, but we don't let them.
Okay.
So I was just talking with a facilitator who told me that this rule is being broken all the time. But we tend to say, you know, 12 years or older are the best ages to come to StoryCorps, 12, 13, 14. But people will bring younger kids sometimes. Yes, kids. And some of our, you know, really some beautiful interviews that have been broadcast have been with kids. But obviously, you know, there has to be a certain maturity, I think, to participate in StoryCorps. And, you know, that may be something we look at again and maybe take the age down a little bit. But and kids certainly like the, you know, we have a lot of animated stories. Yeah. Now we put a lot of visuals on stories, and it's something that really appeals to kids. And one of the things we're looking at StoryCorps is figuring out how to get into you know, bring these stories of who we are as Americans on, you know, true stories into schools and get kids more involved in StoryCorps. And another thing we do now that we have our app is that every Thanksgiving we have something called the Great Thanksgiving Listen, where teachers across the country assign their students to record an elder over Thanksgiving. And that's something we do in school. So, yes, kids definitely respond to StoryCorps.
Technology has been a boon to oral history, right? But is there a flip side to that in your experience, Dave Isay?
Well, I mean, I technology obviously has been, like, StoryCorps wouldn't exist without technology. Mm-hmm. We started out, we were the first born digital collection, audio collection to go to the Library of Congress. We started out on CDs. Obviously, now we're not working on CDs anymore. You know, with the app, again, the ability to record anytime, any place, it's something I wouldn't have even been able to dream about when we launched StoryCorps. So, but, you know, technology, it's all, for StoryCorps, it's been a boon, I think, in many ways. Obviously, their technology can be used in incredible ways to do good for people. But, you know, going back to what we were talking about earlier, I do think that there have been you know, instances where technology just in general, you know, maybe has not been fantastic for, you know, for society and the kind of, you know, the kind of ways that we relate to each other that I think, StoryCorps, some people call it oral history, some people don't. Obviously we walk in the footsteps of oral historians, academics, people like, you know, Studs Terkel. And, you know, the general ethos of honoring other people by interviewing them, that technology has not done a lot in some cases for helping us, you know, kind of honor and respect one another.
And getting back to what you mentioned earlier about the animation that's been applied to some of the stories, I'm so glad that you've kept doing that. I love watching those.
And that was all about getting to kids, you know, because we live in such a visual world that, you know, that's it's like a gateway drug to listen to the stories.
And and that's going to go forward.
Yes.
With
more
and
more visuals always. Yes.
Well, Dave Isay, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. It's
Thanks,
a privilege,
Anne.
As always.
Great to talk to you again.
Thanks. That's Dave Isay. He's founder of StoryCorps. StoryCorps Mobile Tour is in Columbus through July 31st. Visit the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides for more information. And Columbus Metropolitan Club will host a conversation about storytelling tomorrow in honor of StoryCorps. I'll be moderating the event that will feature the site manager of the StoryCorps Mobile Tour, also the co-founder of TEDx Columbus, Ruth Milligan, and WOSU Public Media General Manager Tom Ryland. For more information on tickets, go to metroclub.org. Thanks so much for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.